introduction, I'd first like to thank Chris and Stu for organising this meeting in this magnificent setting and for inviting me here to give this talk. A word about this talk, and if you don't like it, blame Stu. He asked me to give an introductory talk, which, looking around the audience, I can see will consist entirely of material that is familiar to about 90% of you. So just think the other 10% are really enjoying hearing all this new stuff. For the rest of you, it's a very gentle start to an early Sunday morning, which, may I remind you, is Mother's Day, unless you come from Australia, in which case you're too late. So this is really just an a high-speed introduction to pretty much what we know about polymer models. And I thought I'd start off with some references to some key books in the area. There aren't too many. There's the book by Neil Madras and Gordon Slade on the self-avoiding walk. There's Carlo van der Zander's paperback on lattice models of polymers. There's Buck's book on the statistical mechanics of interacting walks, etc., and a very recent review article which was very up-to-date on directed polymers, and I should have added but ran out of room. There's a very nice volume by Barry Hughes, a colleague of mine at the University of Melbourne, called Random Walks in Random Environments, published by Oxford University Press. So what are polymers? Polymers are long-chain molecules consisting of a large number of monomers held together by chemical bonds. Those made of identical units are called homopolymers, and those made of more than one unit are called heteropolymers or copolymers. And there's a difference in focus depending on your professional interests. Chemists are traditionally interested in local properties, notably the specific chemical properties, while physicists are interested in the more global properties, and mathematicians are, of course, interested in exact solutions or proving properties such as the existence and convexity of a free energy. Roughly speaking, we study polymers usually as lattice models, reflecting the fact that in most real-life polymers we've got fixed bond angles, and also because they're easier. Universality implies that for global properties the precise lattice doesn't matter, which is another good reason for looking at these models on a lattice. And the idealization as random walks, or more usually self-avoiding walks on a lattice, has become a ubiquitous model for polymer properties. The self-avoiding property reflecting the fact that two monomers cannot coexist in the same space point. And we want to measure various things about these polymers, such as how many there are of a given length, that is, of a given number of monomers, and how big they are physically, which is usually measured by mean square end-to-end distance or radius of gyration, etc. This lattice idealization allows many systems beyond polymers, just as simple chains in dilute solution, to be investigated. You can put interactions between nearest neighbor monomers that aren't subsequent monomers on the polymer chain, and you can associate an energy with these, which allows the collapse transition to be investigated, or the interaction between monomers and a wall. So that's the situation here, where the nearest neighbor interactions are shown dotted in this case. If you put an energy associated with these interactions, you can cause the polymer to collapse. Similarly, you can make attractions with the wall both either attractive or repulsive. And the key question that one asks is how the size varies with these, the strength of these interactions. Biological molecules like DNA, RNA and proteins are of course all polymers, and so a lot of the properties of self-avoiding walks have been used to model the important properties of biological molecules, such as denaturation, folding, stretching, etc. Other configurations in which self-avoiding walks join at their endpoints and thereby form loops or polygons are equally rich. And because they enclose an area in two dimensions, or a volume if you consider them made up of faces, we can study pressure-induced phenomena. And the fact that we're dealing with loops means the concept of knottedness can be studied. So there are interesting questions of knot theory arising then. The canonical model of a polymer is a self-avoiding walk or a self-avoiding polygon. There's a self-avoiding walk on a hexagonal lattice. Unfortunately, in trying to solve the problem, it's trivial in one dimension and unsolvable in higher dimensions, in a very generally speaking. In more than three dimensions, the spatial freedom overcomes the self-avoiding constraint, and the self-avoiding walk behaves pretty much like a random walk. In four dimensions, there's logarithmic corrections to that, but otherwise it's correct. And more complex shapes, such as branched polymers and polymer brushes, can also be similarly modelled and studied. And mathematically, another reason we're interested in these models is that they're paradigms of unsolved problems in algebraic combinatorics, and the study of self-avoiding walks encompasses a surprisingly broad range of applications to areas in mathematics, biology, chemistry, and physics. As we've seen, we have applications to macromolecules. They are also relevant to problems in numerical analysis, computing, algorithm design. We use tools from functional analysis in some of the proofs, and they have relevance to knot theory, as we'll see shortly. Well, what can we do? What can we prove? I've said that they're unsolvable in more than one dimension. While that's true, we can still prove certain things. Useful ideas in the study of self-avoiding walks and polygons include concatenation, followed by application of various lemmas, pattern theorems, lace expansions, and the study of analyticity and related properties, and I'll run through all of these briefly. The alternative method of study has been on restricted models that are exactly solvable, and hopefully we haven't thrown out the baby with the bathwater, and there's enough of the intrinsic problem left in these simplified models that tells us something about the underlying self-avoiding walk problem. But in addition, these simpler problems possess intrinsic interests as problems in algebraic combinatorics, and they also provide a platform for the development of proof techniques. An exciting recent development is that of the scaling limit of self-avoiding walks. Is that the scaling limit of self-avoiding walks is described by the so-called stochastic Loebner evolution process with parameter 8/3, known as SLE 8/3, and we might hear more about that later. Then, apart from these rigorous methods, the non-rigorous techniques include numerical methods such as simulation, molecular dynamics, Monte Carlo methods, all of which have added greatly to our understanding of the properties of these models. The theory of conformal invariance and also Coulomb gas concepts has provided many exact, though not rigorous, results for some two-dimensional models, and field theory techniques in general, giving us epsilon expansions, etc., have illuminated our understanding in higher dimensions. All these ideas, as I said, provide non-rigorous, though occasionally exact, results. What is a self-avoiding walk? There it is. That's a path that doesn't cross itself, or if you prefer, there's a more mathematical description, and I'll generally consider walks on the square lattice because they're easier to draw. And if C subscript n denotes the number of n-step self-avoiding walks equivalent up to a translation, we're usually interested in the generating function capital C, where Z is just some dummy variable in the generating function. And if we draw, see how many there are, if we start here, there's 4 one-step walks. At the end of this, I can go in 3 dimensions, giving me 12 two-step walks, and similarly, at this point, I can go in 3 directions, giving me 36 three-step walks. The self-avoiding walk constraint enters only at the 4th step, which means C4 is 100 rather than 108, as you're not allowed to have these guys, and there's clearly 8 of those. Self-avoiding walks can trap in any dimension, D bigger than 1. There's a two-dimensional trap. And on the square lattice, the mean number of steps of a self-trapping walk is about 71. The history of the model begins in the 1940s by a posthumous paper by Orr in 47. As I mentioned, remarkably little can be proved. One of the earliest important results by Hammersley and Morton in 54 is that the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over n log cn exists with mu between 1 and infinity, and the mu being finite and bigger than 1, and that the limit is approached from above. Mu is called the connective constant, or log mu is called the connective constant, depending on whose papers you've read. I'll use this notation, and the physical interpretation of mu is that it's the average number of available steps for an infinitely long walk. So on the square lattice, you can see that eliminating self-reversals means that mu is going to be at most 3, and in fact it's about 2.68. And what this means is that the average number of steps available to a very long walk on the square lattice is about 2.68. And put it another way, 1 over mu is the radius of convergence of the generating function. That's not a corollary because it's not even always true for in higher dimensions. How do we prove this? The usual the idea used by Hammersley and Morton, and that has continued to be a very useful proof technique, is to concatenate N and M step walks. That is, we stick two walks together. Two things can happen. Either they overlap, in which case we don't have a self-avoiding walk, or we generate a new self-avoiding walk. This method generates all such self-avoiding walks, and so we have an inequality in that direction. Cn plus m is less than or equal to Cn Cm. As Cn is greater than 1, we can take logs, giving us this result. This is a subadditive inequality, and an immediate consequence from a lemma given, I think, first in Hiller and Phillips' book, is given that Cn is bounded above, the result follows that lim 1 over n log Cn exists and is bounded above. What this means is that Cn behaves like mu to the n plus little o of n. This is far from our belief that Cn behaves asymptotically like mu to the n with a subdominant term n to the g, because if we translate that into this notation, it means that instead of being little o of n, it's in fact big O of log n, which is a great deal sharper. The only known result is for the value of mu is that on the hexagonal lattice, mu is square root of 2 plus root 2. This was first obtained by Bernard Ninhaus in 82 based on Coulomb gas arguments. It's universally believed but not proved. For the square lattice, there's a weaker conjecture, which I made in 84 and still appears to hold true numerically, which is that mu is the solution of this quadratic. And it, when I made the conjecture, it was based on a 7-digit estimate of mu. We now have an 11 or 12-digit estimate of mu, and it still appears to hold. Other things that one does to study mu is to try and establish rigorous upper and lower bounds. Upper bounds are constructed usually by evaluating mu for random walks with short-term memory. That is, we systematically eliminate immediate reversals, then the formation of squares, then the formation of hexagons, octagons, etc., etc. This gives a convergent sequence of algebraic upper bounds. Lower bounds are constructed by constructing lower bounds on a subset of walks, such as bridges, where bridges are a proper subset of saws whose endpoints are the leftmost and rightmost point of the walk. And the state of the art is that mu is bounded below by 2.62 and above by 2.679. As I mentioned, the subdominant term is usually believed to be n to the g, which would give us mu to the n plus big O log n. And indeed, the exponent is known, by which I mean that this is widely held to be true, but based on conformal invariance arguments, among others, so it's not rigorous, but we believe that G is 11 over 32 for all two-dimensional lattices. In three dimensions, conformal invariance doesn't bias anything, so these results come from numerical methods. And in four dimensions, we know that G is zero with logarithmic terms. And for D greater than 4, Hara and Slade have proved that Cn behaves like a mu to the n 1 plus terms of order n to the minus epsilon for any epsilon satisfying this condition. Hence, g is 0 for d greater than 4. For d equals 2 and 3, we've only got these results. So that is, instead of big O log n, we've got big O root n. That was proved by Hammersley and Welsh back in 62, and a slightly different result proved by Keston in 63 and 64. Keston has a slightly tighter result for D bigger than 2. As I say, we'd like to prove that, but we're a long way from there. Only in 1990 did O'Brien prove the obvious result that Cn plus 1 is in fact bigger than Cn. If we turn now to self-avoiding polygons, these are self-avoiding walks whose last monomer is adjacent to the first, so you can close it off. There's a self-avoiding walk starting here, finishing there. We add an extra bond. We have a self-avoiding polygon. Hammersley proved that for self-avoiding polygons and walks, the connective constant is the same. If Pn denotes the number of 2n step self-avoiding polygons equivalent up to a translation, I write 2n here because on Z2, or indeed Z3 for that matter, the polygons have to have an even number of steps. So Pn divided by mu to the 2n is less than a constant and greater than this. The lower bound proved by Hammersley, the upper by Keston. Keston sharpened the upper bound for d greater than 2, and for d equals 2 in 95, Neil Madras proved this quite strong result that Pn over mu to the 2n is less than c over root n rather than a constant here. It's universally believed, again, that it's mu to the 2n n to a power, alpha minus 3, where alpha is a half in two dimensions. Again, following from conformal invariance arguments. In three dimensions, the estimate follows from numerical arguments. In four dimensions, we've got mean field theory results with a logarithmic correction. And for dimensions greater than four, we have the pure mean field theory result, though with non-mean field theory corrections, proved by Harrer and Slade in 92. Turning now to the metric property, size of a self-avoiding walker is measured by the mean square end-to-end distance. That is, we average the end-to-end distance, shown here, R end-to-end distance. We average that over all n-step walks, and that's believed to behave like n to the power 2 nu. Another metric property is the mean square radius of gyration, which also behaves with as n to the 2 nu, where these are the same exponent. That is to say, it doesn't matter what property you use to measure the size. You could even measure the width, the mean width, the mean span, and that too would also behave like n to the nu. For a one-dimensional self-avoiding walk, which is just a linear chain, clearly r squared goes like n squared, and for two-dimensional random walks, it's well known that r squared goes like n. For self-avoiding walks, we write, as I've just mentioned, r squared goes like n to the 2 nu, where nu is 1 for d equals 1. Nu is believed to be 3 quarters for d equals 2. Again, numerical for d equals 3. And for d equals 4, nu is a half with logarithmic corrections. D equals 4 is called the upper critical dimensions. For d bigger than this, random walk behavior is observed. That is, the self-avoiding walk constraint is washed out by the additional dimensions into which the walk can escape. And mu is a half for d greater than 4, also proved by Harrer and Slade. The proofs of Harrer and Slade make use of the Lace expansion. I don't have time to go into that now, but if I may take liberties and describe it as a greatly enhanced inclusion-exclusion argument, and hope that Gordon doesn't stone me. Another powerful tool in proving some of these results is Keston's pattern theorem. A pattern is a short self-avoiding walk that occurs as part of a longer self-avoiding walk. So there's a pattern. That's a reflected pattern. I should have drawn it as the same pattern. And the theorem loosely states that if a pattern can occur three times on a self-avoiding walk, as this one can, then it must occur epsilon n times on almost all self-avoiding walks of length n, where epsilon is greater than naught. So this pattern will occur infinitely often, and this one won't, in short. Turning now to exactly solvable models, there are a number of simple polygon models that are exactly solvable. The first one is Ferrer's diagrams. Second one is staircase polygons, where you have a starting point here, an ending point here, and you have a pair of northeast steps that intersect at the beginning and the end. Convex polygons, column convex polygons, directed convex polygons, directed column convex polygons. The first three can also be solved in three dimensions. Okay, a convex polygon means that there are two ways to look at it. Either if you draw its minimum bounding rectangle, the perimeter of the minimum bounding rectangle is equal to the perimeter of the polygon, or equivalently, if you cut it that way or that way, you will only cut two things. And this one's the convexity constraint applies in only one direction, etc. As I say, these 1, 2, 3 are all exactly solvable in three dimensions as well. Here you get plane partitions. Here you get a Hoyne function. And here you get something that's built up out of that result. they're all solvable because they're in a sense directed. That is the only one that is, I call, quasi-solvable is a three-choice polygon. It's something that looks like this. You start here, you go up, back, up and back, finish there. By quasi-solvable, I mean we have a polynomial time algorithm for its enumeration, and we know the asymptotics, but we don't have a closed form expression for the generating function as we do for those previous examples. Methods of solution for these exactly solvable models. We seek this generating function. Typically, we're looking for a two-variable generating function where z carries the perimeter and q carries the area. P subscript mn is the number of polygons with perimeter m and area n. So that's why I say z and q are the appropriate conjugate variables for the perimeter and area. Sometimes it's even useful to split the perimeter up into the x and y perimeter, and then we have a three-variable generating function where PLMN is the number of polygons with horizontal perimeter L, vertical perimeter M, and area N. These directed models are usually solved by one of three methods. The factorization, or so-called WASP-waste method, where the polygon can be factored at a narrow point. So if we look at, say, staircase polygons, we can express a staircase polygon as either a single cell, or a single cell joined to a staircase polygon, or we can take a staircase polygon and add a cell along to the top row, or we can do that and attach it at this point to another staircase polygon. So if we write down the terms that this corresponds to, if I write S as the generating function for this, then the generating function for this single square is QXY, where I'm only writing down the semi-perimeter. This is QX times S. That is, we increase the area by 1 and we increase the x perimeter by 1. This is S times QX because the variable, the area is increased by an amount given by putting a Q here where the X is, and the height is increased by 1, which gives us a factor Y, and this is again our SQX times S. So we have this functional equation which we can linearize by this substitution, alpha times HQX over HX minus B, where alpha and B are chosen to match the initial conditions. In the simple case of staircase polygons, it's really simple. Works out that A equals, that should be alpha equals B equals Y. And
tell me, how do you spot that that's the right substitution? Is it just sort of the wisdom of our ancestors?
Sorry?
How do you spot that that's the right substitution?
Yeah. That's the standard solution for solving a Riccati equation. For linearizing Riccati equations, rather. And then you can iterate that, and you can then... It transpires that H is given by this Q generalization of a Bessel function, where this is the Q factorial, effectively Q factorial, in the denominator. And so the generating function is given by the quotient of two... Q generalizations of the binomial coefficient. And this method can be applied to a number of those exactly solvable models.
Maybe a small comment to the question. There's a little more to that than meets the eye. The trick doesn't always work.
Yes. True enough.
Well, it's worth trying.
The alternative method is the Temperley methodology, which relies on the observation that the polygon can be built up based on the size of the first column. So if we let HN of ZQ denote the generating functions of polygons whose first column is of height N, which looks a bit artificial, then if the first column is of height 1, we have this situation. The first column is of height 1. What can we say? Well, it's either a single square, or it's connected to one of these guys, or it's connected to something whose first column is of height 2, or it's connected to something whose first column is of height 3. So we have H1 is QZ to the fourth plus QZ squared given by this factor times this is H1, this is H2. So we get this equation. And then we consider H2 and build it up in the same way, H3. And we fairly readily see that the pattern is given by this, which is a relatively straightforward generalization of this with just some extra factors of Z in there. And then you mess around with that and eliminate as many of the H's as you can, and you end up with this quadratic, effectively, recurrence in H. The nasty thing about it is the fact that you've got a Q to the N plus 1 here, so that you can't solve it by the usual simple substitution. That is, the coefficients depend on N, which causes problems. The ansatz is to try this substitution instead of just writing A lambda to the N, which we would do if this term wasn't here. We write lambda to the M times this sum, where Rm and lambda are arbitrary but are chosen appropriately. You substitute this into Hn, choose lambda and Rm in such a way that it leads to a quadratic equation in lambda. The initial conditions allow us to discard one solution. You then end up with a first-order difference equation for Rm, which is iterated to give, of course, the same solution with x equals y equals z as we had before. And there is a third method, which I eliminated to save time, which is not as general. It applies in particular cases. And there are other methods that work in special cases, which and sometimes these methods don't work at all, as Thomas mentioned. For numerical methods, there are two principal methods, Monte Carlo. The trouble with Monte Carlo methods, or not the trouble, the difficulty is developing efficient methods that are ergodic. Most methods also generate too many failed walks. A simple efficient method is the pivot method. That is to say, you take a self-avoiding walk, you take an arbitrary vertex such as this one, and say that all parts of the walk to the right of that I'll pivot through 90 or 180 degrees. So if I take that and pivot it through 90 degrees, I get a new walk. If I pivot it in the other direction, I get an overlap, and that's not a new walk. And so you make sure that you reflect the statistics of this situation correctly, and this turns out to be one of the most efficient ways of generating self-avoiding walks in two dimensions. It was rejected for many years because people thought it was appallingly inefficient, until Alan Sokol proved that while that is actually true, it is less appallingly inefficient than every other method. So in that sense, it's efficient. For numerical methods, the other method that is widely used is to simply count these objects, enumerate them on a computer. This is unfortunately a problem of exponential complexity. For two-dimensional self-avoiding walks, the time taken to count a walk of length n grows as the number of walks, which, as we've seen, grows as mu to the n, which is like 2.64 to the n. And what this means in practice is that the computer time to obtain one more term exceeds that needed to obtain all previous terms. That's simply a consequence of this result and the fact that mu is bigger than 2. So ideally, given that these problems of exponential complexity, you cannot do a whole lot better waiting for the next generation of computers. Moore's law isn't fast enough, so rather we wish to devise algorithms that reduce the complexity. And the most effective trick so far is to work on a finite lattice. And the idea of working on a finite lattice was first suggested by Tom DeNeef and proved to be valid by Ian Enting in the early 70s. With the finite lattice, you can use a transfer matrix and you can count everything that's on that finite lattice quite effectively. So here's an example. Here's our finite lattice. We're going to count polygons. We've got this structure here, and we're sweeping this line through to build up the transfer matrix one vertex at a time. So this is our previous configuration. When we see what happens at this vertex, we're adding one more configuration. And so we go systematically through the lattice, starting here, going up here, down here, up, down, etc., and build up the possible configurations until the lattice is filled. We count everything that's on such a lattice, then we increase the size of the lattice by one, do it again, and incorporate the statistics appropriately. Over the years, Ian Enting has refined the method, improving its complexity for self-avoiding polygons, for which the method is more efficient, because self-avoiding polygons, because they have to come back to their start, fit on a smaller lattice than a self-avoiding walk, which can stretch from one end to the other. And Ian and Enting and I have gradually extended the data by which I mean the perimeter 2n for which the exact number of self-avoiding polygons is known. In 92, Andrew Conway, a PhD student of mine, made it work for self-avoiding walks. More recently, Andrew Rogers, another PhD student, and Ivan Jensen have improved the algorithm for both walks and polygons and parallelized it. The problem with the whole method is that it's difficult to program, starting from scratch, and it also has exponentially increasing memory requirements. So our computer on which we develop the program has 16 gigabytes of memory, and then we transfer it to a big computer. Currently, Jensen has got the best version. He's reduced the complexity to 1.2 to the n, compared to direct enumeration with complexity 2.64 to the n. As a result, we have self-avoiding polygons on the square lattice to 110 steps and walks to 59 steps. And generally speaking, this method can be used for other such lattice models. That is, the finite lattice method plus transfer matrices is the best way to enumerate lattice objects in two dimensions. It also works in higher dimensions, but the complexity is unsatisfactory because the time to enumerate an object, a d-dimensional object, grows like n to the d minus 1. So in three dimensions, this grows like lambda to the n squared, which direct counting is better than.
How do you evaluate the complexity?
In some cases, you can do it theoretically. In some cases, we do it empirically. The simple method, originally postulated by Ian, you can relate it to Motzkin words, and you can get factors of 3 to the n out for, or square root of 3 to the n out. For these fancier methods, we do it experimentally. So you've got 110-step polygons or 59-step walks. How do you estimate the critical parameters? That is to say, you've got this belief and you wish to evaluate A, mu, and alpha, the amplitude, connective constant, and the exponent. The best method is the method of differential approximants, which Jeff Joyce and I developed some 30 years ago, and the idea is that you assume that the generating function can be approximated by an ordinary differential equation with polynomial coefficients. The coefficients of the generating function define such an ordinary differential equation, where these polynomials Q0, Q1, Q2, and R have to be yet to be found. There should be equal zero on the right-hand side. The coefficients are uniquely determined up to a constant multiple by forcing inequality coefficient by coefficient until our supply of known coefficients is exhausted. That is to say, we increase the degree of these polynomials, forcing equality with the known coefficients until we can increase the degree no further because we've run out of coefficients. And the ODE can then be exactly solved by standard methods. A connective constant is given by the appropriate zero of Q2. The critical exponent is given by the solution of the initial equation, and the amplitude A requires integration of the ODE. Functions that satisfy such a differential equation are known as differentiably finite functions, or d-finite, and we'll hear more about that in Andrew Rechnitz's talk. They are ubiquitous in the field of mathematical physics. Your hypergeometric functions, etc., are all differentiably finite functions. The realization that some solutions are not d-finite is a significant recent development. For example, the celebrated two-dimensional Ising model, which is a related lattice model but of magnetism, had two of its three most important generating functions calculated by Onsager in 44 and Yang in 52. Both of these solutions are d-finite functions. The third quantity that was of interest to physicists and mathematicians for half a century, the susceptibility, has resisted all attacks for 60 years. In 2001, a team of four showed that the susceptibility is not d-finite. The generating function has a natural boundary on the unit circle, which possibly explains why everyone has had so much difficulty in trying to find this third property. There's a circle of essential singularities, exactly so. Given that we've got this numerical data, can we use that to give us any idea of whether the solution is likely to be definite or not. Again, we'll hear more about this from Andrew, but roughly speaking, one way of doing this is to anisotropize the model, by which I mean distinguish between horizontal and vertical steps. So I keep track of the green and blue steps separately. So the generating function looks like this. If I sum over one of the variables, I can write in this form, when our HNX is the generating function, say, of self-avoiding polygons, with 2n steps in the y direction. So H1 of x is just x over 1 minus x, and H2 of x is x 1 plus x squared over 1 minus x cubed. So you can see the x over 1 minus x comes from this factorization here, and the x 1 plus x squared over 1 minus x cubed comes from the fact that H2 looks like this, and it can be the other way as well. And you can keep calculating these for more and more y steps, and you'll see that H7 of x has a denominator which contains the cyclotomic polynomial 1 plus x squared plus x to the fourth, etc. And very rapidly, though, again, I promise you, Andrew will give you more details. What happens as we build up the number of y steps, the degree of the cyclotomic polynomials that appear in the denominator increases steadily with n. And a consequence of this is that such a function, roughly speaking, cannot be definite. So what we're saying is that just by doing these numerical experiments, you get a strong clue that definiteness doesn't hold. And if you do a whole lot more work, as Andrew did in the case of self-avoiding polygons, you can refine that observation into a proof. And we'll hear more about that from Andrew. Other applications, you can study polymer collapse or macromolecular folding or surface adsorption, as I showed you with this picture earlier. And going into a little more detail, if CNK now denotes the number of n-step self-avoiding walks or self-avoiding polygons with K contacts, where a contact is one of these nearest neighbor monomer bonds or a monomer wall bond, then you construct the appropriate generating function, CNK e to the beta k, where temperature is now entering by virtue of this parameter beta, with a similar generating function for self-avoiding polygons. So there's the equation again. And according to the size of beta, we can make the interaction attractive or repulsive. For self-avoiding walks, if beta is sufficiently attractive, the object collapses into a space-filling blob. The fractal dimension changes. This exponent nu that describes the mean square end-to-end distance can be thought of as the reciprocal of the fractal dimension. As I mentioned, it was 3/4 for nu is 3/4 in two dimensions, so 1 over nu, the fractal dimensions, is 4/3. And when it collapses into a space-filling ball, of course, in two dimensions, the fractal dimension becomes 2, or nu becomes a half. And at a critical value called the collapse temperature, there is an intermediate phase in which the fractal dimension is 4/7, or nu is 7/4, if you prefer. This change takes place discontinuously. So we have this situation here where this is beta at the critical value. Beta is 7/4. D is 7/4. For higher values of beta in the collapse region, D is 2, and at lower values, it's 4/3. Other things that the free energy is defined to be limit 1 over n log z, where for self-avoiding polygons, the existence of kappa has been proved. Though there are some gaps in the proof for self-avoiding walks, and also the fact that it's monotonic, convex, and independent of K. That last proof, by compliments of our host and hostess at this meeting. And finally, there exist constants B1 and B2, so that P and K are bounded above and below by these two quantities, which differ only by a constant. For knot, just a brief mention of knots. There's a lot of literature denoted to knotted walks and polygons. These model knots in polymers and in particular DNA. Here's a trefoil in Z3, just to show that we can find a trefoil on the web, copy it. Some of the results that we have, Sumners and Whittington in 88 proved that the probability that a three-dimensional polygon is knotted approaches 1 as the length of the polygon increases. As the length gets large, almost all such polygons are knotted. It can be proved, again using Keston's pattern theorem that I mentioned earlier, that the probability of an unknotted polygon is given. The probability of an unknotted polygon divided by the total number of polygons goes like e to the minus alpha n, where alpha is really quite small, and it's been estimated through Monte Carlo simulations that alpha is 7 by 10 to the minus 6. Going back to polygons, if we consider the perimeter area generating function now, we can model the collapse or expansion of vesicles, which are biological molecules, and this idea was first developed by Michael Fisher. So the perimeter area generating function is as shown here. The phase diagram looks like this, where the critical point describes the crossover between self-avoiding polygons and branched polymers. So in this region, we're in the self-avoiding polygon region, and then we go over to branched polymers. That is, the object collapses, and it behaves like a branched polymer. And the behaviour at this critical point here is of particular interest. So that behaviour at that point... there's a big jump to this result, so please just accept it, and you'll hear more about it from Christoph Richard's talk. We believe that in the vicinity of that critical point, the generating function behaves like some regular thing which is of no particular interest to us, times this scaling function, where f is a function of a single variable that depends on this particular variable zc minus z, where this is the departure from the critical value in the z direction, and this is the departure from q equals 1. Just going back to this diagram, this is q equals 1 here, this is z equals zc. So we're measuring departures from this point in the z direction and in the q direction. But this is a single, we can treat this as a single variable omega, and we're interested in the properties of this scaling function f, from which all the critical exponents that I mentioned flow by taking appropriate derivatives. A key assumption is that p satisfies a q-algebraic functional equation, which is a functional equation of the following form, where g is a polynomial in the n plus 3 variables p, p of zq, dot, 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 up to p, q to the nz, zq. And if we make that assumption, which we can show to be true for all the simplified models that we looked at, or looked at is an exaggeration, but that I flashed up earlier. So, for example, for staircase polygons, we have the exact solution, so it's easy to prove that the generating function is indeed of the above form, with n equals 1 here, so we've got just g of p, p of zq, zq, and the scaling function p here takes this form where we can expand this and we get an expansion of the form epsilon to the kappa plus 1 over 3, where now epsilon is 1 minus q. So because rather than keep these rather cumbersome variables, I've replaced this by epsilon and I've replaced this by s. So s now measures deviations from the critical zc, and epsilon measures deviations from the critical q equals 1, and then this variable becomes, in this case, we know the value of phi, it's 2/3, and so this is just s epsilon to the minus 2/3 in the case of staircase polygons, and this is 1/3, but we can expand the whole thing, in which case we get factors of epsilon to the k plus 1 over 3 in here. This is for staircase polygons, so this is exact. And we can find by power counting, though Perlberg has calculated the full scaling function, and we can also determine it, of course, from the complete solution, that f naught, the dominant scaling function, is given by the logarithmic derivative of an airy function. That gives us f naught, and f1 turns out to be identically zero. And Christoph has subsequently calculated the fk's for higher values of k. Now, interestingly, so this is for a solved model, but for self-avoiding polygons, under the above assumption for P, that is, it satisfies such a functional equation, it follows that rooted self-avoiding polygons behave in the scaling limit exactly as do staircase polygons. This is a consequence of the same square root singularity in the perimeter generating function, which means that the critical exponents theta and phi that I have here are exactly the same for rooted self-avoiding polygons as for staircase polygons. And then it follows by power counting that you end up with a similar differential equation for F. That is to say, it implies that F naught satisfies this Riccati equation, F squared minus 4F1, F dash minus F naught squared equals 0, where F naught and F1 are constants. And hence, by using a similar linearization trick to the one that I showed earlier for the functional equation for staircase polygons, it follows that, again, the F0 is given by the logarithmic derivative of an airy function, F1 is 0. And this has considerable numerical support, as was shown a couple of years ago. So I'll stop there and just give my personal opinion as to where we go from here and what's happening. In my opinion, the most exciting ideas in this field are the development of exact scaling functions, as I've just outlined, which are spearheaded by Christoph Rickard, and we'll hear more about that later. And the stochastic Loebner evolution equations ideas, which I haven't discussed at all, spearheaded by Schramm, Werner, Smirnov, Rhoda, and Lawler. That development, coupled with the proof of some ideas from the theory of conformal invariance, have signaled the beginning, I think, of an exciting new chapter in the study of such problems. It's likely that many conjectures that we have will now be provable. If you want to see more about that, there's a very nice talk that was given by David Wilson when he visited Australia last year, which is still available on the website of the conference at the Australian National University, www.maths.anu.edu.au/conferences/CIM, and you click on speakers and download David Wilson's talk. Thank you very much.
There's a paper by Cardi also talking about the Airy function appearing in the same model. Have you seen that?
Yes, we sent him our paper and he wrote that in subsequently.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So we're in constant communication over these problems. Yeah.
So about this definite stuff, which I never have understood very well. So you've given examples of problems which are exactly solvable where the solution turns out to be a classical examples of problems in statistical mechanics which you can solve exactly where the solution doesn't turn out to be defined.
Yes, many. So three-dimensional convex polygons are one. Anything with a logarithm in it is not definite. A three-dimensional specific E to the easing model is not definite.
Okay, so turning out to not definite isn't a real problem.
No. Non-definiteness is not.
Just eliminates a whole bunch of techniques.
Yeah, I understand that, but it doesn't mean that there isn't some other way to. It doesn't indicate there isn't some other way to do it. Just have a look in a new class of.
Well, all these Q generalizations are, of course, a new class.
Yeah.
It basically means that your chance of guessing a solution by some technique is zero. It means that if you're going to get a solution out of it, it means you're going to have to work a hell of a lot harder than just. The things that Tony's presented here, for example.
So, for example, if you look at, well, not that we know that it's difficult, in fact, we know that it's not definite, but if you look at three-choice polygons, then Murray has proved that the denominators just have a very simple pattern of the form 1 minus x to the 2n plus something or other. But so you only get that single site, that one lowest order cyclotomic polynomial appearing. We still haven't solved the model, but it indicates that it's worth making the effort because it's probably not going to be too horrible.
Okay, maybe we finish on time and we can go on to the next talk.